Docket, State of Louisiana versus United States Department of Education, and we'll hear from Mr. Starcher.
Good evening, Your Honors. Jack Starcher on behalf of the United States. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
The district court here erred in numerous respects in issuing a sweeping injunction against the entirety of the Department of Education's 2024 Title IX regulation. But perhaps the most central or foundational of those errors was the district court's misunderstanding of the interaction between two different provisions within that regulation. The first of those provisions, Section 10610, is about a single question, and that question is what it means to act on the basis of sex in certain contexts. And the second distinct question is the question addressed in 10631A2, which addresses what it means to discriminate in contexts where a school or recipient has decided to treat students differently on the basis of sex. That first provision, 10610, properly understood, addresses a single scenario, and that scenario mirrors the facts that were before the court, the Supreme Court, I should say, in Bostock. And those facts are where it is conceded or understood that a school has engaged in intentional discrimination against a student or otherwise based on gender identity. And in those circumstances, that's the fact pattern where a school has put a student in detention for being transgender or has kicked a student off of a club or activity for being transgender, for being gay. Those are the circumstances addressed by 10610, and just as in Bostock, that violates the plain text of the statute. Just as an employer would violate Title VII by firing an employee for being transgender, a recipient violates Title IX when they treat someone differently and discriminate against someone based on their gender identity.
What if an institution repeatedly and openly allows its students to engage in what might reasonably be known as discrimination?
That would be covered by a different provision, which is 10602. That's the harassment or hostile environment provision, and I think that's a sort of third distinct question presented by this case, and I'm happy to discuss that. But I do, just before moving on to discuss anything about that, just want to, you know, emphasize that the plaintiff states certainly make clear in their briefing that they do not intend to engage in the sort of Bostock type discrimination, which is, again, explicit direct discrimination against someone on the basis of their gender identity. So this is the school equivalent of firing someone for being trans. Again, you can think of numerous examples that fall into that bucket. But again, plaintiffs say that they don't intend to or want to do that. But just to be clear, the result of plaintiffs' arguments, and certainly the result of an injunction against Section 10610 in particular, would mean that Title IX has nothing to say about those kinds of discrimination. And that outcome is simply incompatible with the reasoning of the Supreme Court's decision in Bostock and the basic textual understanding and textual sort of statutory interpretation analysis that the Supreme Court engaged in that case.
So we would have to, in your view, engraft the Title VII reasoning into our own reasoning on Title IX, is that right?
To some extent, although I guess I would, in grafting, I think you would look to the way that Bostock analyzed the words, the operative words at issue under Title VII, which were the words because of sex, and then the reasoning about what those words naturally mean, the clear, unavoidable, natural meaning of that text, which is what the Supreme Court focused on in Bostock, leads to the same sort of unavoidable conclusion for those same or materially similar words in Title IX. And that core insight of Bostock, which is it is impossible to explain what it is you're doing when you are intentionally discriminating against someone based on their gender identity without consideration of that person's sex. And so necessarily, discrimination based on gender identity is discrimination based on sex. And that's true, I think, importantly, on this front. You know, plaintiffs' sort of textual responses to Bostock's reasoning, many of their textual responses focus on the best or natural reading or meaning of the word sex, but importantly, really all of plaintiffs' arguments are in support of a reading of sex that the Department of Education accepted for purposes of this provision of the rule, and the Supreme Court assumed in its reasoning. In other words, even if sex is understood to mean or to reference the real, you know, sort of physiological differences between men and women based on their sex at birth, even if understood that way, discrimination based on gender identity still is necessarily a form of discrimination. And I'm happy to turn to talking about either the harassment provisions or the sex-separated spaces provisions, but I do, before moving on, just want to make sure that I underscore that the district court's decision to enjoin that provision, 106.10, the one that we've been talking about and that our position is flows sort of unavoidably from the basic understanding of those words in Bostock, that particular aspect of this district court's decision should be vacated on the basis that I've just sort of laid out.
Do you agree that for a preliminary injunction, assuming it's otherwise proper, that the extent of the remedy can be broader than what might ultimately be proper for a permanent injunction? I believe the case law says that.
The case law says that the scope of a preliminary injunction must be narrowly directed at addressing the irreparable harm that the plaintiffs identified. And obviously the plaintiffs bear the burden of establishing their entitlement not just to preliminary injunctive relief, but to the scope of that relief as well. And I don't know if Your Honor is referring to case law or sort of the suggestion that maintaining the status quo is somehow a standard that trumps at this stage, and that maintaining the status quo can independently justify a broader injunction than you might otherwise think. But this court addressed that exact form of inquiry in Parks 517 F3rd 787. And in that case, this court squarely held that while status quo often is coterminous with or relates to an appropriate scope of injunction, maintaining the status quo is never in and of itself an appropriate or relevant touchstone for the scope of preliminary injunctive relief. And that is because the purpose of a preliminary injunction is to prevent irreparable harm. And so unless plaintiffs established that the scope of the injunction they received is necessary to prevent irreparable harms to them, then the injunction is overbroad to the extent it does more than is needed to address those harms. And on that front, I do want to get back to the sort of merits of some of these provisions, but while we're talking about scope of injunction, I do just want to highlight that the focus of the briefing, the focus of the district court's decision, the focus really of the harms that plaintiffs have set out is overwhelmingly focused on sex-separated spaces, and in particular, bathrooms, locker rooms, changing rooms, and the like. And again, as sort of suggested by my opening discussion, all of those issues and any sort of harms arising in those spaces relate not to the rule as a whole, and certainly not to 106.10, and not to the harassment standard, but to 106.31a2, which again is the provision of the rule that explains and sets out the standard for deciding when a school engages in discrimination in contexts where the school has decided to expressly separate students on the basis of their sex. And that's the de minimis harm standard set out in the first sentence of that provision.
So does the Department of Justice agree that there's an important privacy interest that needs to be considered? Is that a significant interest or one that we don't need to be concerned with?
So the Department of Justice, and I think more importantly, the Department of Education in the rule made clear that yes, privacy interests are real. Privacy interests in particularly spaces like bathrooms, locker rooms, changing rooms, showers are legitimate. the point that the department made in response to comments received in this space was not that those concerns are not legitimate. It's that the record before the agency on this question, number one, did not support sort of the bottom line of many comments received, which was the existence of transgender people in these sex-separated spaces necessarily poses serious privacy or safety concerns. That was a conclusion that the department found no support for in the record. And secondly—
No support at all for the privacy concerns.
Not for the privacy concerns. Again, so the department acknowledged the privacy concerns are real. I think the point I'm trying to make is that the department, and this was based on comments received from states who have been doing this now for years, and by doing this, I mean requiring that students have access to these spaces consistent with their gender identity. The comments received from those states and jurisdictions demonstrated to the department that you can respect students, everyone's privacy interests. So students of all stripes, this isn't specific to this rule. This is a truth. I guess I should say privacy interests have existed in locker rooms, bathrooms, showers, et cetera, long before this rule, and those privacy concerns exist even if you don't consider the presence of transgender people in those spaces, right? I mean, in any—
But the presence of such persons now does add an extra element of concern regarding privacy.
So the department's response on this point was to say, yes, privacy concerns are real, but again, the experience of states and jurisdictions that have been doing this suggests that schools can take account of those privacy concerns and can take steps to remedy those kinds of privacy concerns in a way that does not discriminate based on gender identity. And so numerous states came forward and said, representing about half the country, so this has been going on for some time now, came forward and said, listen, we've been able to address these concerns. We have not had serious problems arise where cisgender students or any other student has felt uncomfortable because of the presence of transgender students in these locker rooms and where those concerns—
I thought there were some examples, at least in the briefing, and maybe some of it was from Amici, about examples of young women who felt embarrassed or that their privacy had been violated. Do you dispute the validity of those?
No, Your Honor. Again, the point I was making was that those, or at least to my knowledge, and I don't think plaintiffs have pointed to any, those sorts of anecdotes or testimonials were not part of the record at the rulemaking stage, and this is, right, an APA rulemaking review, but to squarely address those concerns as raised sort of at the, again, I think amici stage and then some other related litigation challenging this rule across the country. Again, there are states that have been doing this that came forward in comments and explained that there are ways—
Well, I know, and you, in response to my question, you said that three times, so I appreciate
sorry.
That.
Yes.
It's not a problem, I just, you've already said that.
Right.
So Title IX is substantially directed at making sure that that women are not denied the benefits of educational services. Now, that's my paraphrase, but is that fair to say?
No. I mean, I don't think that's reflected at all in the statutory text that Congress chose to enact. That the text that Congress enacted does not create or talk about sort of a separate or more protective standard for one sex or the other. It includes and sets forth a broad, clear mandate that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex against anyone. I take your point, and I agree with you that if you look at legislative history and sort of other extra-textual factors, that was certainly what was front of Congress's mind when it was crafting this scheme. But the scheme
we only get there if there is some ambiguity in the language or the text.
That's right. That you only get to sort of those extra-textual legislative history factors if the text is unclear, and on this score, again, Bostock is, I think, very much on point. The bottom line holding of Bostock, I mean, exactly these kinds of arguments about purpose and intent of Congress were before the court in Bostock. The defendants in that case argued very strongly that, of course, when Congress passed Title VII, it wasn't thinking about protecting people based on their gender identity or sexual orientation, but the court said that didn't matter because the text of the statute, which is what the interpretation of the statute must turn on, the words on the page, was unambiguous on this front. And again, this goes back to the 10610 holding about what it means to discriminate on the basis of sex. And again, on the basis of sex is the key text that's being interpreted by 10610. And again, there's just really no textual response on the other side to the meaning of that phrase. Sex, no matter how you understand it, combined with a but-for causation standard, which is how the Supreme Court interpreted Title VII and how, you know, courts have, for a very long time, including this court, interpreted Title IX and Title VII in parity in terms of what it is that they require on the causation showing.
Insofar as the denial of the benefits of educational services is a proper focus, assuming that that's right, would you agree that lack of privacy in one's essential day-to-day functioning in restrooms and locker rooms and in intramural sports could be seen as denying the full benefits of the educational services that are being provided by an institution that's receiving the federal funds?
So I guess a few responses to that. First, I just want to make sure to flag it because it was mentioned that the sports, consideration of sports, intramural sports, other kinds of sports, competitive athletics is clearly carved out of this regulation.
No, not intramural sports.
I'm sorry. I can take a interscholastic and intercollegiate athletic competition, I guess.
Right, but there's all kinds of, there's a lot more.
Sure.
Young people who in school who participate in intramural sports than are actually on the athletic teams that compete with other schools.
So my understanding is that all kinds of competitive sports, and again, I include within that intramural sports, are exempted from this rule by the 106.31(a)(2)'s express incorporation of 106.41(b). It explicitly says that provision does not apply in the context of interscholastic or
Well, that's not how I was reading the materials, but I mean, are you telling us that if during PE period there's a basketball scrimmage?
I see.
That's exempt somehow, or
what? So PE is different, and I don't want to get too off track here. PE and classes are subject to a different set of regulations. PE has not really been the focus. I know it's mentioned in some of the briefing, but there's a reason it really hasn't been the focus of this litigation, and instead the focus has been on bathrooms, locker rooms. And that's because there's an entirely separate regulatory scheme that dictates when and under what circumstances you can have sex-separated classes, like a PE class, and there are limitations on your ability to be able to do that. One of the important limitations is it has to be entirely voluntary, and you have to be able to opt out and say, no, I want to participate in a class that's not sex-separated in that way.
So a young woman would be denied the benefits of educational services by saying, I don't want this great big burly guy coming in here and competing against me for in let's say basketball or volleyball.
So right, and so in PE classes, there's also a separate regulation that allows schools, and this predates this rule and isn't challenged in this rule. This is 106.34(a)(2), that allows schools to engage in ability grouping based on neutral, so non-sex-based characteristics. So you could have a PE class say that we're going to put people above a certain weight or height in this group A and above a, you know, below a certain weight or height in the group B. And as long as that's done in a way that isn't discrimination on the basis of sex, as long as it's a neutral, evenly applied criteria, that can be fine. And of course, you can imagine circumstances where even as applied to a class of all cisgender people, you know, develop differently. And if someone goes through puberty very early, you can imagine how that would be a useful standard to apply across many.
That strikes me as really silly, what you're telling us. I mean, you're telling us that if there's one biological male who is in the PE class and they're playing, let's say, volleyball or basketball, what do? You get the really big, burly girls to play on that team with him? Is that the plan?
This is a pre-existing regulation, and again, I think it's really, it wasn't a focus in the comments or.
Well, you know, we have to understand how the real world works if we're going to uphold.
Sure, and I think
this rule and your explanation, I think, is completely unrealistic.
I disagree, and I point. This is a, you know, just to take a step back at this point, this discussion, and I agree with you that it's an important one, but this discussion is about particular applications of one single provision, and really more the second sentence of that provision. That's this 106.31A2 provision that we've been talking about quite a lot. These concerns that we're discussing now, if the court has these concerns about the specific application of this rule to sex-separated classes or bathrooms, locker rooms, et cetera, again, I would just take a half step back and remind this court that if that's what this court is concerned about, the proper course is to vacate the injunction except for as to that provision, because all of these concerns and all of the harms that plaintiffs have identified arising from these concerns would be fully redressed by an injunction that enjoined only that provision of the rule and left in place the 106.10 provision, which is again about the sort of exactly the sort of discrimination at issue in Bostock, and also, we haven't really talked about this yet, but would also leave intact the many, many, many provisions of this rule that are not related to and do not turn on any of the rules, sort of discussion of these gender identity issues that have formed.
We haven't yet talked about the harassment provision. You mentioned it earlier, but we
yes.
haven't arrived. And what constitutes a hostile environment? And to comply with Title IX, does the department believe that educators and even other students must use the desired pronouns of transgender students?
No, and this was so long as there is a reason why the person doesn't want to, or you know, they have some First Amendment interest or other interest in not using those pronouns. No, as the rule makes clear in responding to these sorts of
pronouns. So you're saying the consistent or persistent misgendering of a student would not create a hostile environment?
So it well might, and let me just tease out why those are different. Compelling someone to say something particular, especially in the sort of hostile environment context, is very different from telling someone that they cannot engage in repeated, consistent, to borrow the terms from the regulation, severe or pervasive and objectively and subjectively offensive conduct that would create a hostile environment. And I think just a hypothetical gets at this. Before this rule was issued, and taking into account nothing about gender identity, suppose a male science teacher was deeply of the view that women are not able to be as good at math as men. There is a difference between that teacher holding that view and maybe even expressing it in his personal life or responding to a direct question about whether or not he holds that view on the one hand, and then that teacher every day opening his class by saying, all the women in this class, by the way, I really encourage you to drop out because my view is that you will never be as successful in this class as your male counterparts.
That's completely different from a science teacher who would say the male students have a penis and the female students have a vagina. So, and the male students are going to be called he because they have the XY chromosomes, and the female students are going to be called she because they're XX. That's so completely different from some attitude about who's different, who's more qualified in math.
So
if a student, a young girl, let's take a hypothetical, has known Charlie for a long time since they were in pre-K together, and all of a sudden Charlie is a sixth grader and he wants to be called Susie and wants to be called referred to as she, you're saying that the young girl, if she persistently says, no, this is Charlie, I've known him since he was in pre-K, if that's done consistently, she can be guilty of harassment, and if the school tolerates that, then the school could be charged with harassment.
So just to draw, and my time is drawing short, but you know, the purpose of that hypothetical was not to say that those two situations were equal in all circumstances. The point I was trying to make was that there's a difference between prohibiting repeated offensive speech that makes a student feel uncomfortable and unable to participate in their educational program or activity on the one hand, and compelling someone to say something. And so in the hypothetical you gave, and then I'll finish up, in the hypothetical you gave, what would be expected is that the school would work with that student and say, well, you don't want to call this student by Susie or whatever their new name is. What are some other options we can come up with that will allow you to express your views in a way that is not, you know, going to deprive this other student of their access to an educational program or activity? That's the standard. And again, I would just note that if you look across this court's Title IX harassment jurisprudence, there's speech all over it. And so this idea that somehow speech potentially running afoul of Title IX is new is just incorrect. But with that, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Starcher, and you've saved time for rebuttal. Ms. Patterson?
May it please the court, Autumn Hammett Patterson arguing on behalf of Louisiana plaintiffs. I will address the preliminary injunction factors, and then Ms. Thompson will present argument on behalf of Rapides Parish School Board. General Aguinaga will then finish by focusing on the scope of relief issue. The rule is contrary to law and unmoored from Title IX's text, which is why most of defendants' brief glosses over the statutory text altogether. Defendants' justification for the rule boils down to an argument that the rule is a straightforward application of Bostock. But we know that's wrong for at least two reasons. First, Bostock's text-driven reasoning regarding Title VII does not apply to Title IX for several reasons. The Supreme Court expressly limited the opinion to Title VII and the specific question in that case. It refused to prejudge the issue of bathrooms in the Title VII context.
In fact, it explicitly said we're not dealing with bathrooms and those sorts of things. Didn't it say that?
Exactly, Your Honor. And so it just can't be the case that Bostock mandates a specific bathroom policy in the Title IX context. Now, opposing counsel kept trying to suggest that Section 106.10 has nothing to say about treating individuals consistently with their gender identity or bathrooms and things like that, but that's just not true. If you look to page 33809 of the rule, it says, when it's talking about 106.10, to comply with the prohibition on gender identity discrimination, a recipient must not treat individuals more or less favorably based on gender identity. And it's described in more detail in 106.31, generally may not prevent a person from participating in its educational program or activity. So it's baked into section 106.10 there as well, Your Honor, and it does that. Also, Bostock doesn't apply because this court's precedent, such as Rosa H., dictates that courts should be reluctant to treat Title IX's anti-discrimination provisions in the same way that they treat Title VII's provision. And that instruction makes sense.
What do we do with the fact that included in the plaintiffs here are also the states of Montana and Idaho? And I believe that the Ninth Circuit's ruling on whether or not Bostock applies to Title IX is different from what it is in the circuit. What do we do? What authority do we have to issue a ruling that's contrary to, I think it's the Grabowski case from the Ninth Circuit, that specifically applied Bostock to Title IX? What do we in the Fifth Circuit do with that as it relates to Montana and Idaho?
Yes, Your Honor. So a few responses to that. First, I want to note that defendants didn't raise any venue argument here, so anything like that is forfeited. Second, that case that you're referring to didn't address the rule the court has at issue.
But correct me if I'm wrong, did it specifically say that Bostock applied to Title IX cases?
In the context of sexual orientation, I believe it did, Your Honor. But so, first of all, plaintiffs take the position that Bostock does not apply for various reasons. But even assuming that Bostock does apply, the rule still goes far beyond Bostock, and so it still can't be justified. And there's all the arguments about arbitrary and capricious.
How does it go beyond Bostock? How?
Because it expands it beyond, it doesn't, Bostock said on the basis of transgender, in the rule itself, it uses the term gender identity, which is a broader term, which the rule itself recognizes at 33.818 and 33.810. plaintiffs provided an example on page 31 of plaintiff's brief about how it is possible to discriminate on the basis of gender identity without discriminating on the basis of sex, applying the simple test in Bostock. Because in Bostock, the question is whether the trait or action that is not tolerated is the same regardless of sex. And if a religious student group would exclude a person who claims a non-binary gender identity, one of the plethora of different identities they could claim, that person's going to be excluded regardless of whether the person is a boy or a girl, so regardless of sex. So the rule therefore necessarily goes even farther than Bostock.
Ms. Patterson, correct me if I'm wrong. I think our sister circuits around the country who have grappled with this did so in the context of a kind of fact-specific, as-applied challenge. This one is a facial challenge. So tell me what difference that makes into how we confront this.
Yeah, so it makes a difference in a couple different ways. One, in a lot of those cases, at issue was a specific policy with a specific plaintiff who presented evidence in that case. Here, of course, we have an APA challenge, so there's all the arbitrary and capricious arguments and stuff like that. But when defendants say that there's no evidence of harm, that is wrong for several reasons. One, on page 45 of our brief, we cite evidence of harm that was in the administrative record. We compiled exhibits that were submitted as comments. And in response, the government in the rule simply just said it disagreed. It didn't explain it. That's part of the sort of conclusory statement that this court has repeatedly said, such as in Louisiana versus Department of Energy, is insufficient to survive arbitrary and capricious review. It simply points out that some courts have found no evidence of harm, but that was in those specific cases. In one of the cases, the defendants just pointed to the plaintiff's complaint for evidence. They didn't submit evidence. Here there was evidence that they didn't respond to. You have the evidence.
But it's Louisiana's view that there is no hypothetical, theoretical, conceivable, possible, legal application under any facts. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I quite understand. Application of the rule where...
No, I'm just circling back to the global kind of facial nature of the challenge here.
Oh.
There's no possible, permissible application.
Your Honor, I think you're in... When the Supreme Court talks about facial challenges to statutes, that's different. It's talking about a statute where on a facial challenge, you have to show the unlawful applications disproportionately outweigh the lawful ones. That's not what the court is supposed to do in the APA context. As the Supreme Court says in Loperbright, the APA was designed to serve as a check on administrative agencies. So the question is whether it's a faithful application. So the fact that there are examples where the rule goes beyond the statute and prohibits discrimination based on things that are obviously not sex, applying Bostock's own test, means the rule goes too far. And maybe the department can go back and try again and develop a rule that flows from the statutory text. But that's not this rule. So it's contrary to law and it exceeds their authority because they're not a democratically enacted legislature. And it's also important to note that this is Title IX was enacted pursuant to the spending clause, which means the conditions that Title IX imposes must be unambiguously clear. And for nearly 50 years, agencies, courts, and states have interpreted Title IX as only prohibiting discrimination based on biological sex and as allowing sex-specific facilities and athletics. And so that means the rule's new conditions are not unambiguously clear from Title IX's text.
Okay. And so the spending clause argument goes to the regulation or to the statute?
My point is that those regulations are evidence of the original public meaning of the statute. When the court analyzes the spending clause, the question is about the statute itself. Okay. And so I'm saying that the rule's interpretation of the statute cannot be right because that, for nearly 50 years, that is not how it's been interpreted. So that's how those arguments work together.
But didn't Bostock also speak to that? Didn't Bostock also say that there could be new, unexpected ways that words are applied?
Title VII is not a spending clause provision, and so the Supreme Court didn't talk about that at all. And the issue was also, I am looking at what the text means. I think the regulations are still powerful evidence of the original public meaning, as Justice Gorsuch said in his concurrence in Kaiser versus Wilkie. And opposing counsel is focused in on one phrase, discrimination because of or on the basis of. I point the court to Professor Bradley's amicus brief that gets into that. But even putting that aside, that's not how you do textual analysis. You're supposed to take a step back and look at the statute as a whole. And there are many differences between Title VII and Title IX. Not only are there multiple exceptions in Section 1681, which shows, unlike in Title VII, that was supposed to eradicate it altogether, that in Title VII, in Title IX, Congress recognized that there was value in still having some single-sex activities, like Boy Scouts, like sororities. And then on top of that, Title IX has a rule of construction in 1686, and you don't have that in Title VII. And that says, you know, nothing contained herein shall be construed to prohibit any educational institution from maintaining separate living facilities for the different sexes. And that makes sense because recipients aren't discriminating on the basis of sex in contexts where the sexes are not similarly situated, like bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, and athletics. And that also flows from precedent. I'm recognizing that sex is not a stereotype. And when it comes to bathrooms, sex is the relevant requirement in determining who gets access. And that's in the Adams opinion at note 6, Your Honors.
You also argue, as I understand it, a violation of the major questions doctrine?
Yes, Your Honor. We argue that as well. It's another reason. It's just unreasonable to think that Congress gave this sort of authority to the agency to decide such a major question. Defendants entirely ignore the enormous construction costs and to schools to construct new bathrooms and create the privacy and all that. And so it's also an issue.
Are new bathrooms required under the regulations?
They are, Your Honor. The department disputes that and they claim it's not. But the rule also says that you're discriminating on the basis of gender identity if you treat someone worse. And the rule recognizes that there are many individuals who don't claim a male or a female gender identity. And so for those individuals, the recipients would have to create a new bathroom for them, or they could argue that they're being treated worse because they don't have their own bathroom like individuals who claim to be male. They don't have their own bathroom like individuals who claim to be female. So that suggests that it does indeed require some of these construction costs and things like that. Also, the department said that it doesn't raise privacy concerns, pointing out that recipients could build.
I don't recall them saying that they did not raise privacy concerns. I think they said on this record none were presented.
Respectfully, Your Honor, they ignore the evidence there, and they only address individuals who are sincere and claiming a different gender identity. They also don't address any of the evidence pointing out that bad actors can exploit it, because unlike the policies at issue in these other cases, they don't allow the same sort of documentation requirements and things of that nature, and it's open to the entire community. So adults who come to attend a sporting event can use whatever bathroom they want, and again, it doesn't deal with the gender identity issue. I see my time has expired, so unless I can answer any more questions.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. Ms. Thompson?
Thank you, Judge Smith. May it please the court. There's been a lot of discussion of 10610 here, and we agree with the states that the department has gone too far, not only in interpreting Title IX's text, which is different than Title VII, as if it necessarily incorporates Bostock, but also in crafting a rule that goes beyond what Bostock said. I'd also like to zoom in on 10631A2, the provision that even the department agrees is going to require allowing males to access girls' locker rooms, restrooms, and showers. There's no dispute about that. And girls lack equal opportunity in education if they aren't able to go into the girls' locker room in order to change for PE class. Speaking of PE class, until today, there's been no dispute that sex-separate PE classes are allowed by the regulations, but would be subject to the new de minimis harm provision. So that means that when girls are in gym class and playing volleyball, if there's a male who identifies as female, he's got to be allowed to be in that gym class and play forward for one of the teams where all of the other girls will have to compete against him. I don't think there's any reasonable dispute about that, and that is a
creating serious risk of injury.
Absolutely.
Not to mention humiliation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Girls are not going to be able to have equal opportunity if we ignore the real biological differences between male and female. Any understanding of Title IX and Section 1681A, even on the department's reading, has got to recognize that women's sports are okay. And the rule can only do that by engaging in a sort of linguistic gymnastics where it brings in a regulation 10641B that has no basis in the statutory text and then puts it into the exceptions from 10631A2 as if it were a statutory provision. It's problematic enough to carve out the statutes, but just looking at that athletics regulation is one good indication that 10631A2 cannot reflect the correct interpretation of the statute. If sports can be exempted from this rule, then the rule is not being faithful to the statutory text. There are other textual problems with 10631A2 as well. As Ms. Patterson mentioned, it ignores Title IX's rule of construction. A rule of construction is not an exception from the statute. If you think of a statute as sort of a math formula, it would be a provision that distributes across the other provisions. You've got to interpret those other provisions to be consistent with the rule of construction. And here that's the rule allowing for separate living facilities for the different sexes. That provision shows that Bostock's core but-for causation text doesn't work in Title IX. Because if you're assigning boys and girls to student housing, which even the government agrees qualifies as a living facility, the only distinction on which you're making the decision is going to be their sex, male or female. That means that Bostock's but-for causation cannot apply, at least as it pertains to student housing. So it's important that that's a rule of construction because it means that 1681A, the core non-discrimination provision itself, allows for sex-specific decision-making. In other contexts, the government actually recognizes this because, of course, there's no statutory provision for locker rooms, toilets, and shower facilities, assuming they don't count as living facilities, which is what the rule concludes. So there would be no statutory exception for locker rooms, showers, and toilets. And yet, the regulations since 1975 have allowed them in 10633. If the government is right that it's not biology that makes students differently situated when it comes to those separations, then there was no rational basis for it ever. There was no rationale at all for ever having sex-separate facilities. That doesn't pass the laugh test. Everyone knows that there are biological differences that matter. Justice Ginsburg called them enduring, and the original public meaning of 1681A reflects that Title IX respects biological differences, and it recognizes that there are legitimate circumstances where male and female students are not similarly situated. That's true throughout Title IX, and the 1975 regulations are a great illustration of how that works. They recognized, for example, that PE classes can be separate, that sex education classes can be separate. They recognized that athletics can be separate. Circling back to that, certainly we think that this regulation does sweep in athletics because, as my colleague pointed out, even the rule's preamble says that 10610 is going to require treating someone consistent with their gender identity. It's hard to say that you can redefine sex-based discrimination and have no impact at all on sports. That if you destroy women's sports in Title IX, then you've destroyed one of the core achievements of that statute. And any reading that does that should certainly be rejected. But even beyond that, it doesn't really matter whether the provision extends to sports or not. And it doesn't really matter whether, you know, which side of the line intramural sports fall on exactly, because the way the department has had to do linguistic gymnastics in order to get around the result of its reading shows that its reading is wrong. 1681A has got to respect those biological differences, and it has got to allow these distinctions where the sexes are differently situated. I'll just turn briefly to the hostile environment harassment standard as well. There are at least three problems with this. We've touched on them a bit already. First, even setting aside First Amendment problems, the agency has taken the exact same statutory text from 1681A and has reinterpreted it and made it a broader level of liability. That's just contrary to the statute. There's a longstanding Supreme Court interpretation of what discrimination on the basis of sex means in the hostile environment harassment context, and the agency doesn't dispute that it has imposed a broader standard. It doesn't make any sense to say that what schools have to do to combat hostile environment harassment is different depending on whether they've been sued in a private lawsuit or whether they've been sued by the agency. If anything, that lends itself to arbitrary enforcement because the agency can come in and start enforcing the rule in a way that no one expected. Second, there are the constitutional concerns, viewpoint discrimination, and then even beyond that, vagueness and overbreadth. Viewpoint discrimination, 10631A2 has said that it is discrimination, more than de minimis harm as a matter of law, to prevent someone from participating consistent with their gender identity. Once you put that in with the new definition of hostile environment harassment, if you don't use someone's preferred pronouns, or if you say something that makes them feel uncomfortable, like they're not being allowed to participate based on their gender identity, you're at the very least risking getting called into the principal's office to talk about potential harassment here. That's going to chill speech, and that itself is a problem.
How do you respond to the argument that the plaintiff states cannot assert constitutional rights of their citizens? In the I guess it's the Haling versus Brackeen case. How do you respond to that argument?
So, Your Honor, the school board and the states are not asserting their citizens' own constitutional rights. They're asserting their own interest in not being forced to violate other people's constitutional rights. It's true that the rule applies to schools, not to individuals. And so what the department has done here is using spending clause legislation, coercing states and school districts into adopting policies that at the very least chill free speech, which is itself a violation, and also compel speech on certain viewpoints.
pardon me, I was wondering, is there an answer to the question of where textually within Title IX does the de minimis harm standard come from?
Hard to say. Your Honor, it seems like the department's idea it's loosely based on general concepts of de minimis harm. And of course, there's case law recognizing in lots of anti-discrimination statutes that a de minimis harm is not actionable. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that Davis recognizes that even if there's liability for hostile environment harassing, you know, just teasing is not going to count. Discrimination statutes are not supposed to be a general civility code. That's what the de minimis harm principle traditionally has meant.
Right.
But the department has taken that concept and twisted it into this strange amalgamation of statutes and regulations where suddenly something that no one would have ever thought was discrimination at all, like sex-specific locker rooms, has been turned into de minimis harm, but only for gender identity. I'm sorry, more than de minimis harm, but only for gender identity, not for any other characteristic. And it makes whether someone is harmed totally untethered from biological sex, which as even the department recognizes is the one characteristic that the statute actually protects. So the combination of these provisions, 10610, which expands it beyond sex to all of these other characteristics, 10631A2, which creates this new form of discrimination, but it's gerrymandered, so it only applies to some things and not others, and it ignores the biological basis for all of them, meaning that there's no reason for the sex separation in the first place. And then 106.2's definition of hostile environment harassment, which wraps all of these together with a broader standard of liability, where the government has stated in multiple guidance documents and amicus briefs that things like, quote, misgendering or not using someone's preferred pronouns are going to constitute harassment. All of those things mean that this rule is likely contrary to law. The district court was correct to issue preliminary relief.
All right, thank you, Ms. Thompson. Mr. Agonada.
Thank you, Judge Smith, and may it please the court. I'd like to close with just a few brief points on scope of relief. The first is that after the Supreme Court's decision in this case, I think the only real question in this appeal is whether the district court properly exercised its discretion by enjoining the rule in its entirety. And I start with the Supreme Court's decision because if the court has any doubt about the propriety of the district court's injunction as to the three core provisions of the final rule, I'd ask you, I'd urge the court to take Justice Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch at their word. Paragraph 1 of Justice Sotomayor's dissent says, every member of the court agrees respondents are entitled to interim relief as to these three provisions. Now, the government can get up here and tell you that that's preliminary and dicta because of the procedural posture at the Supreme Court. But if that's dicta, I mean, my goodness, that is the most compelling dicta I've ever seen from the Supreme Court, because you have nine members of the court going out of their way to emphasize that we are entitled to preliminary injunctive relief as to those three core provisions.
Actually, we have plenty of case law that says that we should pay a lot of attention to Supreme Court dicta.
That's exactly right, Judge Smith, and that's why I think, you know, in terms of those three core provisions, this case is open and shut because you have all nine justices saying we're entitled to relief on those provisions. So that's why I say that I think the only real question at this stage in the proceedings is whether the district court erred, abused its discretion by going further and enjoining the final rule in its entirety. And on that point, I would just note for the court, over the weekend, I pulled the website with the final rule's text, and I did a search of how many times does the term sex discrimination appear in that final rule. It appears 2,106 times. How many times does the term hostile environment appear in the final rule? It appears 417 times. I think the reality is that once you enjoin the provisions affecting the definition of sex discrimination and the definition of hostile environment harassment, you've got the rule. And Judge Smith, something you said earlier resonated with me. You said you've got to look at how the real world works. I mean, to put this in stark terms, if I go to Chick-fil-A and I order a chicken sandwich, but I say, hold the bread and hold the chicken, at that point, I'm really just ordering two pickles. That's not a chicken sandwich. And that's the reality here, is that the very essence of the final rule stems from these three core provisions. And once you remove those, the final rule loses its very character. And so I think for that fundamental reason, the district court absolutely was well within its discretion to enjoin the final rule in its entirety. Now, the second point, which I'll make very quickly, is that I think it's important to note that the federal government lost its severability argument at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court told the government, you haven't sufficiently identified specific provisions that you think could independently survive.
Whose burden is that at this juncture of the case?
At this juncture, the burden's cut both ways. Of course, it was our burden as plaintiffs to establish the propriety of the preliminary injunction. The standard of review here for this court is abuse of discretion. I think the question before you is, did the district court abuse its discretion by entering the injunction it did? And my only point in reprising what happened in the Supreme Court is to say that when the Supreme Court told the government, you haven't sufficiently identified specific provisions you think could survive an injunction against the core provisions, they come back here and what do they give you? They give you four bullets on page 26 of the reply brief, four bullets. And to be honest, I was shocked to read those bullets, because when I pulled those bullets, the provisions they cite, and this is their best shot at what they think could survive an injunction against the three core provisions, what those provisions say, I mean, actually destroys their severability argument. And I'll just give you my favorite example on page 26. They cite the definition of complainant. They say that the definition of complainant in 106.2 could survive an injunction against the three core provisions. Well, I'd urge the court, if you haven't looked, look at the definition of complainant. It is someone who is alleged to have suffered, have been subject to sex discrimination. The very definition that we have successfully challenged in the district court. And so it was shocking to me to see the government say, well, all these other provisions that necessarily depend on those three core provisions could somehow survive an injunction against those core provisions. And I think what Chief Judge Sutton recognized in the Tennessee case and what the 11th Circuit recognized in the Alabama case is that it's no surprise that when these terms appear 2,500 times throughout the final rule, it's no surprise that they touch literally every aspect of the final rule. And the district court had no obligation to go line by line and question, well, I don't know if this provision could survive an injunction against the core provisions, and so I'm going to let that one go. That's not the district court's obligation. And to make matters worse, talking about real-world consequences, Judge Smith, I mean, the government's position here is that you, school boards, teachers, students, parents, you guys figure out how this final rule would work without those core provisions. With all due respect to the government, that is not a sustainable position. It's preposterous, and the district court properly exercised its discretion in entering the preliminary injunction. If the court has no further questions, I'm happy to sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Agnoli. Mr. Starcher for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In the rule, and I'm going to page 33,820. The rule says that letting men into women's restrooms, locker rooms, and other private facilities does not, quote, compromise anyone's legitimate privacy interest. What does that mean?
So that was responding to, I think if you look earlier in that same sentence, that was responding to specifically comments that were about this assertion that necessarily every time a transgender person exists in one of these spaces, that that compromises real legitimate privacy interests. I think the more, and I can, I didn't bring this with me, but.
Okay, that's all right.
I would point as the more relevant reference, this was 89 Federal Reg 33820, that says nothing in the rule prohibits recipients from taking non-discriminatory steps to ensure privacy and safety for all students in a recipient's sex-separated facilities, steps that many recipients already take consistent with their general codes of conduct, including rules prohibiting harassment, assault, other forms of misconduct, et cetera. So I would point that to the part of the rule that acknowledges that privacy and safety concerns exist in the world and that recipients can and do respond to those privacy concerns in numerous ways. I guess just a few quick points on rebuttal. Plaintiffs, again, during their presentation to this court, focus repeatedly, and as this question that we were just discussing focuses on the rule's application to situations in which schools separate students based on sex. That's bathrooms, locker rooms, changing rooms, et cetera. If this court were to vacate the preliminary injunction that exists and say we vacate it except to the extent the injunction prohibits the Department of Justice or the Department of Education from enforcing 106.31A2, and you could even go broader and say to the extent the injunction prohibits the Department of Education from enforcing the rule in the context of those sex-separated spaces, I present that would fully address all of the harms and all of the concerns that plaintiffs have raised and all of the irreparable harms that plaintiffs have identified.
I just want to make sure, I appreciate you making that distinction and it's helpful, but you're not saying that the department agrees to that, but you're saying that would be a way that we could,
yes, and I
we
appreciate
could give the plaintiffs part of their relief, but not all.
Yes, I appreciate you allowing me. Like, I'm not conceding that all of the arguments we've made, we still think that too would be an incorrect injunction. But
and I know you have your points that you want to make, but how do you respond to the major questions doctrine issue that came up on the other side?
Yeah, so the major questions concerns that, unlike the spending clause, which is, on the spending clause, just quickly, I would point this court to the Supreme Court's decision in Jackson discussing how to assess a spending clause challenge against Title IX, which we satisfy here. But on major questions doctrine, that is an issue that is common between Title VII and Title IX. That doctrine would equally apply to that statute.
And in fact, didn't come up in Bostick.
It didn't come up, and I think more importantly than not coming up again, Bostock made very clear that it wasn't finding that the prohibition against discrimination on the basis of sex is clear, and that the holding of Bostock, the conclusion of Bostock, which again is reflected the core holding in 106.10, arises naturally and unavoidably from the plain text of the statute. So this is not a situation where some new, unexpected, or surprising authority is being asserted. This is, again, per the Supreme Court, the unavoidable, natural, plain meaning of the words on the page. And so that makes this very different. I would also just add one of the big costs invoked by the other side in sort of the major questions doctrine space is the idea that somehow the rule requires the construction of sort of a third set of bathrooms for people who are non-binary, but that very squarely was addressed in the rule. The rule at 89 Fed Reg 33.818 says section 106.31A2 does not specify how a recipient must provide access to sex-separated facilities for students who do not identify as male or female. So the rule clearly said we're not imposing obligations to create gender-neutral or sort of third-option bathroom. The rule made that clear, and there's no suggestion that you shouldn't take the word of this rule.
We've asked you a lot of questions. Is there anything that you'd like to touch on that you haven't had a chance to? I'm not asking you to repeat yourself or summarize,
yep.
But if there's something else you'd like to touch on, you may do so briefly.
Sure, just one last point that is, I'm pretty sure not repeating myself. This idea that the definition, that 106.10 provision runs through the whole rule and is somehow the core provision, and that every other provision of the rule necessarily relies on it, that assertion is inconsistent with the reality, which is since the 1970s, Title IX has never had a definition of what it means to discriminate on the basis of sex. And this court and other courts and recipients and students and schools have been very able to understand and apply Title IX regulations that have existed for the past 50 years, even though those regulations refer a lot to sex discrimination. So my point is, if you were to enjoin 106.10, every other provision of the rule, just because it mentions sex discrimination, is not somehow inextricably wound up with that. Things about lactation spaces and grievance procedures and other provisions of the rule that really have nothing to do with what we've been talking about today can and should be allowed to go into effect. I think that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Darcher. Your case is under submission, and the court is in recess.